outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your guide to the whitetail woods. Presented by First Light, creating proven, versatile hunting apparel for the stand, saddle, or blind. First Light, go farther, stay longer. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon. This week on the show, I'm joined by Mark Drury's farm managers, Wade Robinson and Perry Batten, to discuss the habitat strategies they employ to create world-class whitetail hunts. All right, welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by First Light. And today we are kicking off another series, and it is Habitat Month. That's right, 4 straight weeks of whitetail habitat discussions. We're going to cover everything from food plots to timber stand improvement to grass management and water holes and hinge cutting and who the heck knows, soil health, regenerative agriculture, everything from this way to that way, everything we can be doing to improve our properties for deer and deer hunting and all sorts of other critters too. I think that's an important thing to remember. We have an opportunity and I would say an obligation to not only, you know, steward our landscapes for the creatures we want to hunt, but also for all of those other creatures out there who share that landscape, the birds and the bees and the pollinators and turkeys, squirrels, rabbits, raccoons. It's all an interconnected system. And by working to improve these places, we can help that entire ecosystem, which I think is a pretty darn cool thing. So that's why I'm particularly excited take off another month of this habitat kind of discussion. I found myself a lot last season dreaming about, oh man, I wish I could have done this thing, or I wish I'd improved this area. I wish I could have, you know, tweaked this food plot in this kind of way, or I wonder what I should do different next year. There's been a lot of those kinds of questions, as you all know, or at least longtime listeners. You know, I had a really fun hunting season last year, re-energized and excited to do some new things this year. So there's going to be a lot of work done on my side on a property I have permission on, and then on my family deer camp up north. Hopefully we'll be doing some work too. So we'll be exploring some of those ideas as we go along. But like I said, it's Habitat Month, and we're kicking things off today with a really great duo of guests, and I'm going to give you a little bit of background on them in a second. But I want to first give you, I'm not going to say homework, but I want to give you some extra reading material. If you want to dive deeper into these different habitat ideas that we're going to discuss today and this month, I wanted to share 4 different, well, it might be actually 5 different reading recommendations. If you follow my Instagram account over at Wired to Hunt, you know I'm a big reader, always digging into different things, and that applies to deer and habitat related topics too. And so I've got five books here that I highly recommend if you want to get more habitat ideas, if you want some more detailed insight into how to improve and manage your land for wildlife and whitetails. Here are some recommendations. First, I'm a really big fan of Whitetail Deer Management and Habitat Improvement. Very creative title. That's the title of a book by Steve Bartilla. Steve's been on the show in the past. We've talked habitat in the past with him. And this book is, it does a really good job of covering the whole slate of management questions, habitat improvements. But particularly, he has a lot of illustrations, maps where he showcases his plans, his designs, how he, you know, plots out different things, how he puts in access routes and food plots and habitat and cover improvements, all that kind of good stuff like that. The diagrams are really helpful. A lot of good pictures that showcase some of the work he does. So that's a really good one. Another great book, if you want to really get into the nitty-gritty of food plots, this is probably the top book I would recommend if you are starting as a food plotter and just need like everything from A to Z covered. It's Quality Food Plots, and it's published by the Quality Deer Management Association, or well, it was published by the QDMA. Now they're known as the National Deer Association. I believe they still sell it on their website. So that's called Quality Food Plots. Really, really good kind of step-by-step-by-step as far as everything you need to know to prepare locations, to choose locations, to amend the soil, to, you know, take soil tests, to choosing the right seed to plant, to how to manage it, you know, just everything. So definitely check that one out. The next set of books is a duo here as well, and it is Whitetail Habitat Success by Design and Food Plot Success by Design. The first book is kind of a more holistic set of ideas across all habitat projects, while the second one is very food plot focused. But both of these books, what I like about them, written by Jeff Sturgis, of course, is Jeff's approach to habitat management and improvement. It's very system focused. By that, I mean, he does not recommend anything in isolation. He's not going to say, just plant a food plot wherever, and here's what you should plant in it, and here's why. No, it's always connected. He discusses and really emphasizes the connected nature of everything on a property. So if you put a food plot here, what does that mean for the bedding? And what does that mean for your access? And how do all these things interact? And how will the deer movement change? And how will that impact how you can get in and out or how you should hunt? And so it's a very strategic approach to habitat improvements and to food plot design, location, planting, all that stuff. It's very, very good. So if you want to take that next step in your habitat work, in your food plotting work, these two are really good, really diving into that. You know, how does this all impact a hunting strategy? And then last, another book called Grow 'Em Right by Neil and Craig Doherty. Another really good overview of a bunch of different things when it comes to habitat improvement and more of a habitat management philosophy. I think there's definitely some how-tos in here, but I love the philosophy that Neil and Craig share here. Craig was a mentor of mine previous to his passing, and I can't tell you how much I appreciated some of the things he taught me early on. And I think this book does a great job of continuing sharing some of those messages and insights to people through the written word. So those are my five habitat book recommendations. Check them out if you want to further your foundation in this kind of stuff. So that is a long roundabout way of getting to our main kind of topic of discussion, which is how Mark Drury has such amazing whitetail hunting properties. How does he get these amazing deer year after year after year? How does he keep so many deer in these areas? How does he have so many quality hunts? How does he manage these places so darn well, so consistently? That's our topic of discussion. And we're doing it with the two guys who are the blood, sweat, and tears behind Mark Drury's, or at least behind much of Mark Drury's success. Not saying he's not doing a lot of this work too, but he has the help of Wade Robinson and Perry Batten, his farm managers, who are out there seemingly every day doing some kind of project. And my goal today was to get a behind-the-scenes look at just what they're doing, how they're doing it, what the strategies are that they're employing, you know, how they think about food plot design, food plot location, what they plant, where they planted, how they planted, how they deal with drought. What are the little tweaks and tiny details that they focus on that most people don't? I think that's something that really stands out about Mark is his attention to detail, not just with hunting, but with his property designs and habitat improvements. And we're going to dive into that as well. There's some really interesting things there that that Wade and Perry share. So that's the game plan. Wade and Perry are good guys, smart guys, hard workers, and they really know how to do this work and do it well. That's why I was so excited to have them on the show. And that's the game plan for today's episode. So without any further ado, let's listen to Wade Robinson and Perry Batten, and then I will definitely recommend you guys check out everything the guys over the Drury Outdoors team are doing on their DeerCast app, their YouTube channel. It's all great stuff. So without further ado, Wade and Perry. All right, with me now on the line, I've got Mark Drury's terrible twosome of Wade Robinson and Perry Batten. Guys, thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Yes, sir. No problem.
I'm glad we're finally getting to chat. I've talked to Mark a lot over the years and have been there to HQ and hung out, but I've yet to get to bump into you guys. So I'm glad we're finally connecting and talking about something that I know that all three of us really love. And this time of year, I think it's top of all of our minds, which is habitat work, which is working the ground, growing, you know, wildlife and making for some cool memories out there. So I got to start with a quick question for you both. Right now, you know, as we're getting into like late winter, maybe you'd call this, are you resting and recouping at all? Or do you feel like you're revving up already into like the busy season already because you can see like 19,000 different things already on your to-do list to prepare for next year? How do you feel right now on that?
You know, going into this time of year, we just finished up Missouri end of January 15th. And this is a time that if we're going to take a little week vacation or a long weekend, this is a time to do it. But like I say, the work definitely doesn't slow down. We, you know, this morning we were already putting out analogics and trying to keep the deer healthy, bringing them into next year. So,
yeah. And I mean, we certainly have a little bit shorter days kind of due to the season and, you know, hot, cold, if the ground's not frozen, we can't do some of the things we want to do. And then, like tonight, Wade and I are going to go coyote hunting, so it'll be a long night, long hours, if you will. It's something we enjoy, but, you know, we certainly have some shorter days now that the season's over, but we don't shut down.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's part of the beauty of it, right? It's fun stuff all year round. A lot of work, but you like doing it.
Exactly. We finish up and, just to start over again.
Yeah. So here's something I want to kind of kick things off with a little bit, and that's, you know, the fact that there's so many folks that have watched the product of what you guys do, right? I mean, people have watched Mark's and your guys' hunts on TV and YouTube for years. They've seen all these, you know, beautiful looking places. They've seen these big old deer. They've seen the hunts. And I think a lot of folks make assumptions based on that. I think a lot of folks kind of know, oh, this is how it goes, or this is what they must be doing, or this is how it is. I mean, I think even maybe for you guys yourselves, before you started working for Mark, I imagine you had an idea of, you know, what it was that was going on behind the scenes. So my question for you is, if you had to kind of put yourselves in the listener's shoes right now, and if you were just an average guy listening to this podcast, making assumptions about, you know, how things go when it comes to creating the kind of hunting that you guys have and that Mark has, what's one assumption that you think people make that is wrong? What's one thing that we should just like get off the table right now that's wrong that a lot of people think is true? Either one of you can jump.
Well, we've never stepped foot one in a high fence.
Yep.
That's probably one of the biggest things. And another thing is, our property sizes. Everybody thinks that we're hunting these 1,000-acre farms, you know, 5,000-acre farms, and that's definitely not the case. Granted, I started probably 12 years ago, and in the earlier years, we had some bigger farms right around that 1,000-acre mark. But here over the last 5 years, we've made a huge transition into a smaller satellite farms type approach.
And biggest acreage consecutive farm we have currently is 417 acres.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, which is a big farm, but I mean, we're also hunting 40 acre farms, 50 acre farms, and a ton of 80 acre farms.
Yeah. You know, a lot of 80s, some 120s. couple 40s across both states, Iowa and Missouri. But yeah, definitely the high fence comment, and that we have, you know, 5,000 acres that's manicured like someone's yard to hunt is a false statement. So
yeah, but I mean, and the hours and work that, like you just said, the hours and work that myself, Perry, Mark, Terry, Forrest, you know, we all put into these farms is what they're seeing in that, you know, 30-minute episode on TV. You don't get to see that the hours, days, blood, sweat, tears that go into this these farms.
Yeah, everybody just sees the 30-minute episode on TV or YouTube and think these guys got a great. Well,
it looks so
not
easy.
Always great. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, this morning our work truck, the starter was clicking. So that, you know, just right off the bat, you know, some Monday morning, it's not Monday, but just simple things like that can make your day go south real quick. So,
yeah. Speaking of Monday mornings, I saw a meme today that made me chuckle. It said, Mondays are a stick that looks like a shed. And I thought, yep. You see that stick up there and you go running after like, ah, shit, that's not a shed.
Exactly.
Anyways, to that one main assumption about the farm size, I think that's really interesting what you were saying, Wade, about this transition you guys made. What was that? What was the thought process about that? What led to Mark wanting to switch from the big farms to the bunch of small pieces and satellite kind of approach?
Yeah. So my very first year, 2012, I started in the summer and Mark was so excited. We had all these great deer on camera in, you know, June, July, and then all of a sudden August hit and bam, EHD hit. One of the hardest years other than 2008, it hit really hard, but in 2012, it hit so hard and literally wiped out. We had, you know, a couple different bigger farms, you know, it just wiped out the whole population of bucks, basically. I mean, we had some nice bucks to still chase, but it wiped out 80% of our deer. So, you know, Mark was kind of talking to different guys and stuff and, you know, this guy's farm over here, 5 miles, didn't even get touched with the HD. They never found a dead deer one. So Mark's thinking, he's like, man, we gotta, you know, broaden our spectrum here. We got to get out of these big farms because if EHD hits, it wipes out your whole year or your whole, you know, 5 years. Next 5 years is tough. So he went to the more satellite type approach because EHD is so spotty. It allows you to get hit over here and not ruin, you know, the next 5 years to come. So we just bounce around to the different 40, 50, 80 acre pieces. Granted, like Perry said, we have, you know, we do have a couple other farms that are a little bit bigger in size. You know, 417 acres is our largest track right now, consecutive track. Granted, you know, there's like-minded managers that are our neighbors in some of these spots, but our largest track is 417 acres. So, you know, basically the main reason was EHD and hunting a bunch of different deer herds. You're more likely to have a really good deer versus, you know, your farm get hit 1 year and you have to wait, you know, 3 to 5 years to have another really nice deer to chase. And so far, man, it's definitely been paying off.
So outside of just the EHD kind of risk mitigation, what about how, you know, has it panned out the way you guys thought from, you know, being able to still hunt and hold big deer side of things? Because the risk a lot of times people worry about with these small properties is that you just don't have as much influence over what deer make it through, your age structure, all that kind of stuff. Have you seen, like, is the satellite approach harder or is it easier because you have so many other options and you can, you know, check this farm, this farm, this farm?
Well, I mean, I would say that, I mean, it's definitely harder to raise and grow a big deer. Granted, we've done it. We've had deer that, you know, I have those deer that stay on those smaller parcels and just don't leave. But you know, I think it can be a little harder in that regards, but you just have to find the right farm, the right small farm, and make it as good as possible, have food, have cover. And, you know, that's the main thing is you know, you have these smaller farms, but make that smaller farm the best possible farm it can be is the main, main thing.
Yeah, I would add to that also is, you know, we have a little bit of risk factor when it comes to all of our smaller farms because we have to deal with more neighbors. Granted, as many farms as we have some really, really good neighbors that are on the same mindset as us. I mean, there's a few, you know, bad apples here and there, but that's just part of the game. And also to add to the small farm is intrusion. Like, we do not step foot on these places.
Shed season is about the only time in planting and hunting.
And
some of them, you know, we'll hunt only once.
Yeah.
Twice a year.
If there's not like a definite mature deer that's on the list to kill, we might not step foot on it one time.
But we'll plant it and act like there's a 200 on it. You know?
Correct. Yeah. Every farm gets treated the same as far as food plots and access and everything goes on the setup. But if the mature deer is not there to kill, we don't mess with it.
No.
Let them grow.
Yeah. You mentioned, Wade, I think it was you, who said that a big part of it is getting the right small farm. What have you guys found so far when it comes to identifying like a small farm that can actually perform, you know, at a higher level, that can hunt bigger or hold, you know, more deer? Have you guys kind of fine-tuned what it takes to find that right small farm yet?
Yeah. I mean, again, the number one part of that is due diligence on the neighbors and what they're killing and what, you know, what they're willing to pass. That is, I would say, 90% of it, because if they're shooting every 2 and 3 year old buck that, you know, walks by them, I mean, you're shooting for the moon at that point.
Neighbors
is probably number one, due diligence on that. And then, you know, obviously you want a good ratio between cover and open ground so that you could plant food and hold deer, or have a lot of cover around you and plant, you know, have a lot of cover on the neighbors and plant your big food on your open ground. So, I mean, we have different farms that we have different tactics on.
Both.
Yeah. I mean, we have a 50 acre lease that's all open tillable, but it butts up to about 1500 acre block of timber. Well, obviously there's acorns and stuff in the timber, but you know, we plant a big food plot and early and late season, you know, like taking candy from a baby, they all, you know, on a wide open tillable field, you know, we'll see 70, 80, 100 deer a night. You know, just main goal is to plant food and make them want to be on that property.
Yeah.
The neighbors in that country he's talking about are pretty good too, though.
Yeah.
Everyone over there kind of wants to shoot big deer and late season and early season, we do well there because we always got food. So
yeah, with that,
and that is a lot of,
go ahead.
That is a big thing that a lot of people overlook. They're like, why do you guys have all the deer? Why are you seeing 50, 70, you know, 80 deer a night? Well, you know, we got food. Like, people think that, you know, that these deer are just going to come out to a cut field. Yeah, they will, if that's all that they got around, you know, cause there's residual and stuff out there. But you might see,
if there's
8 deer, you might see 12 deer.
There's a standing field next by, they're going to that one.
Yeah. Especially with these, well, not so harsh the past couple of years, but harsher winters here in southern Iowa, northern Missouri. You know, you get snow on standing food, you'll have all the deer.
So would you say, and I know that I hesitate to even ask the question because I know it's always situation dependent, but if you had to rank order the importance of the different major factors in whitetail habitat when you guys are trying to, you know, make one of these small properties the best it can be, if you had to rank, you know, food, cover, water, and let's say access, how would you rank those four? If you had to, you know, taking out, you know, all the unique variables, just if we had to average it out, how would you rank those four things? You know, either one of you, Perry, you want to start?
I would say cover is number one. You can't have, I mean, deer don't live in a wide open cut cornfield, cut bean field. You know, you can own 40 acres of tillable. If there's no cover around it, you have no wildlife. So I would say that was number one. And I think access for me would be number two. And then food being number three. I think that'd be the top for me.
Interesting.
because honestly, you can have the best looking farm in the United States, but if your access is horrible, you might as well just chalk it up as a loss, because you're going to blow them and spook them every time you try to go to it.
Yeah. What do you think, Wade?
I agree with Perry. You know, I would obviously, like Perry said, the cover, they're not going to go bed in a wide open corn or bean field. You know, so I mean, yeah, it's hard to argue the cover, but access has always been number one for me. Just like Perry said, if you have bad access, you're going to blow the deer out that you're supposedly hunting before you even see them. And 95% of the time, you don't even know that you did it. You know, they won't even let you know. You just won't have a good sit. You won't see any deer. You'll get skunked. So access is, in my opinion, number one, in any type of hunting. You gotta be able to get in there without them knowing that you're there. And then, obviously, cover for them to stay in, and food. I mean, if you don't have no food, particularly late, they are not going to come by you very regularly. So, yep. And then obviously water's great during the rut, but you know, we started doing some water holes, over the last couple years. And, you know, this past fall we've had, probably 1, 2, 3 different bucks, that were mature that, you know, we could have killed over water. We
almost killed one on a water hole.
Yeah. Killed one, on a water hole. So,
the only reason I didn't rank water high is because, you know, you can rent a track hoe, you can hire somebody, you can put water where you want, really. You know, we've taken fields that are flat food plot, you know, get a track hoe in there and dig you a water hole, kind of design the setup, you know, right. Might take a little bit of time to get some random fill it up, but I mean, you can get water where you want, really.
Yeah. And most of these farms have, in Iowa particularly, you know, it's so hilly and ditchy, you know, there's water about anywhere.
Yeah,
you know,
small trees, small ponds.
They can get their water about anywhere, so it's not as a big of a factor for us here in Iowa and Missouri.
Yeah. Now, I guess here's a slightly different way to look at that same kind of topic. If you've got, let's say, just like an average piece of dirt that's got some cover, it's got some openings, it's got a stream or a pond or something, so there's a little bit of everything on it. What have you found to be, you know, if you had to pick like the most impactful project, if there was, you know, if I told you, hey, you can only work on one project this year, and it's going to be your only improvement you're allowed to make on this average piece of ground that has some openings, it's got some food, it's got some cover, it's already got a little bit of everything, but nothing's great. And you had the opportunity to do one big project. You know, my assumption, I jump to assuming you would put in some awesome food source. Am I right on that? Or is there something else that you would actually find to be more impactful?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Food plot architecture would definitely be number one. Make them come within bow range.
Yeah. And make it as large as feasible to your population on the place and feasible to hunt.
Yeah. And then plan to your position.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's OReillyAuto.com/meateater.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time: Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. And it's really simple. When you pour it into your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff, like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it do its job. Now, you probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again, because people everywhere rely on it to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. So, help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
When you guys started with Mark, and, I mean, you came into this in 2012, Wade, and Perry, it's just been a handful of years now for you, right? Maybe 3 years, is that right?
Yep. Yeah, 3 years now.
Okay, so when you walked in the, you know, quote-unquote door, walk in the door, and Mark takes you out to one of the farms for the first time, or you get out there for the first spring or summer or whenever it was, and you started working on food plots with him, do you remember, you know, I guess what surprised you the most or shocked you, or what stands out when you first got a look at how his mind is when it comes to this stuff, or what his approach is to food plot architecture, or his, or how demanding he is about some aspect of it? Is there anything that stood out when you like got started where you were like, holy crap, this is a different guy, or this is, we're going to be doing things different? What would that be, Wade?
Absolutely. So, yeah. The number one thing is definitely intrusion. Like, whether you're talking out, you don't talk out loud, you make sure you have everything you need for the project at hand and only go into that farm one time. If you forget something, you're going to hear about it. You do not want to go in multiple times if you can help it. That is the number one thing. And again, that goes back to number one with access. You know, like if you're blowing the deer out, if they don't feel comfortable being in your farm, they're not going to be there. So, intrusion and access, two main things right out the get-go.
Yeah, I mean, I just revolt back to me being in the service, attention to detail. Anyone who's been in the service has heard that statement many times, but Mark's very detailed in the way he lays things out and the way we do the work to, you know, conduct that project or whatever it is we might be doing. But, you know, from the littlest details of like, don't mow behind a blind so the deer don't walk behind you or anything like that. Some stuff that I did when I first started because I didn't know any better.
You only do it once.
Yeah, exactly. So definitely attention to details. And that's the reason why he's so successful, why Drury Outdoors and all of us as a whole are so successful.
Are there any other of these little things that stand out to you, like little no-nos, like don't mow behind the blind or any other details that, you know, most folks never think about that in your mind are like big flashing neon lights because of him?
Oh gosh. Yes. We do not go on the farm if there's any risk of ruts. Like his biggest pet peeve is ruts, whether they're half inch deep or a foot deep.
Erosion.
Oh, yeah. Just because our ground is so hilly here, it erodes and then we have to drive across it all the time and it's bumpy. But his deal with erosion and you know, that type of soil conservation is very, very high up in one of those pet peeves.
Don't drive across his yard here at his house. Something I did right off the bat. I took a buggy to go check a board. Oh, yeah. We were shooting, sighting a gun, and I drove the buggy across the yard. He goes, "Don't ever do that again."
You know, so. We don't get off the driveway. It's nothing too major, but it's major to him. And he made those things clear right off the get go. And we do not do that. And we make sure anybody who's in camp knows that ahead of time to save them from the earful.
Details.
Exactly.
Yep.
And I think that's, what has made Drury Outdoors so successful is the detail oriented little stuff
especially, on the small farms we hunt. If the neighbor's intrusive or the neighbor does something we don't, that gives us that little bit of upper hand to get the deer on us, So.
Yeah. So let's take that kind of detail idea and kind of apply it to what you guys just mentioned is probably the most impactful project you guys would usually work on, which is that food. First, I guess when it comes to like a food project and a food plot is choosing the right location for it. And I'm always really interested. I like how you guys do a good job on a lot of these videos of showing, where you're putting new food plots and why you're putting them there and stuff. But I guess at a high level, when you guys are making, looking at the map on a farm and talking about whether it's a new farm or just a piece where you haven't worked yet, and you're trying to choose, okay, where are we going to put the plots? Can you guys walk me through, what those most important criteria are to you when you're thinking through, all right, this is where we need to put it, or this is the easy spot to put one, but no, we can't do it because of X and Y. What would those things be?
Yeah. Well, again, back to our first statement, number one would be access. We got to make sure we can get into these spots without the deer knowing that we're there. And number two, we always use an outside looking in approach. We do not enter the timber. We may carve out a food plot, get a dozer in and do something on the edge, but we just leave the core unpenetrated. And, so we always try and get the deer to come to us versus move in on the deer. Those are two of the, I would say, the most main things
for sure. I mean, it all starts really at Mark's dinner table here at the house. Myself, Wade, and Mark sit down, jump on DeerCast maps and look at it from an aerial view of a map first and say, okay, what winds can we hunt it on? Where's our access going to be? And then design the plot. Yeah. And, going back to what Wade said, most of our plots are on the edge. We don't ever dive deep into a farm because if you do, your access is never good.
Never as good as if it's on the outside.
Right. I mean, our plots are always determined mainly on access and wind direction that we can hunt on.
Yeah.
And so these plots are usually on the edges. They're usually, access related, I guess. How much though do you factor in or worry about, distance to neighbors? So I guess what I'm trying to get at is I've always worried, one of the things you worry is if you put food too close to a property line, too close to the edge, you risk the neighbors impacting that food source or trying to hunt deer coming to it or something like that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, we always definitely take that into consideration. We try and just as being neighborly, we try and, stay away from the lines. I mean, because we've had,
we don't want to benefit a neighbor, but also sometimes you don't have the, on some of these smaller farms we don't have the dirt to
get away from them as much.
Yeah. We have to be somewhat close and that's just kind of how it crumbles down, So.
Yeah, it's all farm dependent, but, again, goes back to our due diligence on, when the neighbors hunt, what time of year, if they're just gun hunting, it may not be as big of an issue,
The biggest thing is no matter how close we might be to the neighbor, normally it's just an access route down a fence line, and then we would get into our food plot where the blind is obviously faced into our ground or the tree stands faced into us. you know, never we're never facing someone else's farm and stuff like that.
However, our neighbors can't always say the same.
Yeah, our neighbors like to.
Yeah.
But
so another thing another question I had related to this location thing is I have often seen Mark talk about trying to tuck them, you know, access is still good, but it seems like you guys tuck them up next to, you know, I've heard like the Buck Hotel and stuff like that. You try to push them pretty close to these bedding areas. So how important is it to be like smack dab against them versus like a transition corridor in between you and the bedding? Like how tight do you want them to be?
I mean, our bow kill type spots are closer to the bedding because, you know, to get those mature bucks up on their feet during daylight hours, you have to be close to that bedding. And you know, Perry can hit on this subject a little bit more, but, you know, if there's not bedding close, we will go in and make bedding, you know, with TSI and hinge cutting and all that type of stuff. So we do like to get in close to that bedding, but yet where our access is still good.
Right. And to his point of that, like when we do TSI, if I, you know, throw my stuff on, grab my saw and just start walking to a general area we've picked out, we want to do TSI. When I get to a spot of that area, I turn around, call it 150 normally is about where it's at, 200 yards.
Yeah, we like to be off the cover.
Yeah, we have the bedding. We like to be off the edge of the food plot to create the bedding. You know, I want to get to that spot where I can't see the field. So that way, when deer bed there, they can't see us get into our blind, our tree stand, and come down our access. So,
yep, that makes sense. Okay. Now another, I guess, tag on to that. I often think about how deer transition, you know, from bedding to a food source to the next food source. You know, how often are you placing food plots in such a way to be like a transition food source versus like the final destination big food source? Like, are you on most of these properties, do you try to have both or just one or the other, or is it never big destination food sources now? It's always little transitions. Like, talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, you know, almost on all of our farms, I would say that we have both. You know, like I was talking about earlier, we just plant to our position. I mean, one of our farms, you know, what is it, 16 acres of ag field that we got?
Yeah.
We got 16 acres in this bottom field, and we direct the deer right past us with walking strips, you know, that walking strips, radish fields, out in the middle of these giant grain destination fields. So yeah, I mean, some way, shape or form, you know, we're hunting these transition areas to get them within bow range, and granted we back off whenever we have a gun in our hands. But
yeah, typically even on small farms, like say we've got 3 acres like at where Mark killed this year over there in the west stuff, 50 acre farm or 48, I think, but you know, we have about two and a half, three acres to work with. We have a green field that's half acre directly in front of the blind. And then surrounding it on the rest of the field, we have standing beans. So kind of a dual-edged sword there. You know, you can hunt it bow season early on the green, and then, you know, gun comes and you got a 120-yard shot and some standing bean field. That we try to keep the deer, you know, destination there and, you know, they're transitioning to both green and grain. And then obviously some filter past us and go out to bigger grain fields, but typically it's very dark and legal light has expired by then. So,
and a lot of these spots where we're back off of the food or back off of the cover rather, you know, we'll go in and we'll make walking strips to help guide them into our green field, like from the, you know, the edge of the timber. Because again, we hunt a lot of blinds. That's another thing that we get a lot of, you know, a headache over. Everybody hates that we're in blinds, but all these spots, you know, we wouldn't be, you know, if we were sitting in a tree on the edge of the timber, you would stop half your movement because your wind would have to be either blowing over the food or blowing over the cover.
Right.
Versus getting off the backside of that food plot and blowing it over, you know, a safe spot. So, you know, sometimes we have to
you know, walk them all the way through that field to get to our within bow range at a radish field or a clover field right in front of the blind, you know, and be standing beans or standing corn elsewhere.
So speaking of that, then, like these big fields versus the smaller fields and how you get them to come past a bow spot. I've seen like this example you described where you do this kind of green and grain combo where you've got that green tight for the mm-hmm. bow shot, and then, you know, they can filter out to the larger bean field or whatever. When it comes to size of these food sources, what's the minimum and maximum size for these food plots that you guys have found to make it effective? And are there some spots where you're like, man, we're going to put a huge food source in and we know this will never be a great bow spot because it's too big, and so you just kind of set up his gun? Or does every single food plot you guys put in has to be like, okay, here's the bow setup and here's the unique thing we're going to do with the design or the, you know, walking strips, and then here's the gun option?
It seems like every one of our food plots has a bow setup, you know, like,
yeah.
Like Perry was saying earlier, whenever we sit down, look over DeerCast maps, you know, we figure out exactly where we need to be able to intercept them going to the big food, what we need to do, whether it be plant or, you know, drive lanes through the beans or what it may be. We always seem to have a bow spot. I think there's maybe two or three of all of our farms that are fields that we just got strictly gun hunt.
Yeah, this year probably. There's only two or three.
And even
some big bean fields that we have, we just go in, set the tiller down and till up a walking strip, you know, and plant green. And yeah. 9 times out of 10, they follow that path.
It's path of least resistance.
Yeah, it's a weird deal that I first saw when I started. And I was like, made a believer out of me real quick.
something so small, even like Perry said, if it's just a walking strip, or granted you don't have a tiller or you don't want to plant green, you know, just driving, you know, your truck through, you know,
yeah.
Granted you have a lease and the farmer leaves 5 acres of standing beans and you drive your truck through those beans, they're going to walk that path, get 25 yards off that path down the middle of the field. And, you know, they're going to walk that path
yep.
and get within bow range. It's something so simple like that, that you could turn a 5-acre food plot and, you know, into a bow hunting type area.
Have a blind out in the middle of the field and, you know, drive your truck, buggy, four-wheeler, whatever you want, make a 2-track and
they're going to walk it.
Yeah. We did it in a spot where we have a big standing grain field that's in the wide open, and then put a scrape tree where we met our tracks together and had a cell cam on it, and it did great. I mean, bucks worked that scrape out in the middle of the no man's land in the middle of a bean field. So,
all right. So I love these little tweaks that you can make to a food plot to make it hunt better. So one of these things that you just mentioned is the walking strips. And so I like the idea of just driving through it. If you don't have the time or tools or whatever to plant these strips of green, you can just drive and make a path. But then when you're doing the green strips,
sure.
Can you tell me in a little more detail how you like to do those green strips? I'm assuming you're planting your beans, or I guess, do you ever do this with corn, or is it always beans? And then what do you usually like to plant in those strips?
No, we do it with both corn or beans. And because the strips are so small, we always do something like a wheat or an oat or a combination wheat, oat, rye. Just because if you do, we've done it in radishes or whatever, they just don't, it'll end up being a dirt strip. So, you know, we always do those.
Something that continues to grow.
Yeah, after they
handle some deer pressure.
Yeah, so that's what we
do to it. Yeah, I mean, biggest thing is like if it's corn, you know, get a little mower in there and mow your path and then till it up and then hand seed it and hand fertilize it. And if it's just beans, you know, we got 6-foot tiller on the back of a tractor and till you a path and, you know, do the same thing, hand seed and hand fertilize.
I would just till right through the crop.
Yeah, till right through the beans. But, you know, like I said, if you don't have that equipment, I mean, somebody could go in there with a lawnmower and, you know, normally underneath that exposed dirt of a crop field, you know, there's enough dirt you could get wheat notes or, you know, something like that to grow.
Even if you just top dress it on top.
Yeah, top dress.
Mow the beans off.
Time of rain and have the rain you know, putting the seed and the fertilizer in. But
yeah, that's a great point. The scrape trees, that's another thing. And I feel like, I think that it was you guys and Mark and everyone who popularized that first. I mean, I can't think of anyone who I remember seeing doing it before him. But so you guys have been doing it a long time.
Mark had the
tree coy.
Mark had the tree coy.
Yep. So it's been really popularized now. Like almost everyone who has food plots does this. It's just such a proven tactic. What are you guys doing now that it's been fine tuned? Like of anyone who's been doing this, you guys have been doing this the longest. What's the fine tuned approach to it now? What are the little things you guys have found that makes this more effective when it comes to like the details? Give me the details of how to do the scrape tree to the Mark Drury level of quality in 2023.
So we started, you know, like I said, maybe a year or two after I started, you know, and we just would go dig a hole with, you know, post diggers and try and bury the tree. Well, we figured that didn't work. So then we started coming in and literally just driving a T-post in the ground and wiring with some thick wire the tree right to the T-post. And that had seemed to work the best for us. And another thing, huge point here that we've found by trial and error, and the best tree bar none is definitely a pin oak. Like we've tried, you know, little locust trees, we've tried
shingle oaks and pin oaks that hold their leaves forever. I mean, they'd be dead and still have leaves on them for months on end, but they just seem to work those trees over
way better,
10 times better than any other tree you can find.
Those are definitely the best trees. And another thing is to make sure your limbs are quartered to the blind. You know, your best scrape limbs. Sometimes we'll trim the backside of the limb so that they can't scrape on the backside of the tree, but quarter those limbs to you so that when the deer comes to work them, you know, they're quartered away broadside for a shot, because they're on the backside of the tree, it does you no good. I mean, you can shoot them coming and going to it, but just to tweak it, to do it perfect, we always, you know, put those trees out there about 18, 19 yards and quarter those scrape limbs right towards the blind.
For sure. But shingle oak, pin oak, it'll work every time.
That's the trick. And do you ever fix them up? Like I've had some times where a tree has lost all its leaves before I was expecting. And I thought to myself, man, I should go and wire up a new branch or something, but then I worry about I don't want to walk out there and leave scent or anything like that. Do you ever go take a piss in the scrape or anything to freshen it up? Is there any other things you would do in season, or do you absolutely leave that stuff alone?
No, I mean, if they break one of our limbs, we'll absolutely, you know, cut a limb off of the same type of tree and go re-add it back, wire it back up. But no, we never start the scrapes or anything like that by pissing in them or, you know, we never mess with them. They just do it on their own. Like
I've seen Wade piss right there where they start scraping and you'll never see a deer there again.
So. Some sainted piss.
Sounds like a personal problem.
if they break the tree down, we'll redo it.
Okay. Camera.
And another little.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
One other little tip that we also do is add two, you know, and make them walk between, almost like a scrape line. They seem to bounce back and forth to those trees. It's just like a fish to structure, and you know, get them walking right there in front of the blind.
Give you that opportunity to shoot one broadside, and you know, stop them walking. That's you know the main goal.
Okay, so that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that before. That kind of ties into another thing you sometimes hear folks talk about, which is some people will put a scrape tree in and then they will purposefully try to get rid of like other licking branches on the field so that the only, you know, good spot for a scrape would be, you know, your scrape tree right within range. And then I've heard other people who like to have like as many licking branches as possible because they want, you know, stuff to keep deer in the area. They want like time wasters so that the buck will stick around and scrape here and scrape there and scrape there and never make it to the neighbors, you know, until after dark. Do you guys ever worry about anything like that, or is that, you know, not on your radar?
No, I mean, that's pretty, deep, I guess. But no, I mean, we don't go cutting any other scrape limbs down or anything like that. Like, kind of like you said, like, I think it's better because whenever a buck's, you know, on that scrape run, he'll hit them all.
And they seem to hit the scrape tree and the natural on the tree line. They'll hit 20 in a row if they got them there, you know.
Yeah.
No, we've never went and cut them down.
So I was going to ask then about your camera setup on the scrape trees now. Those have been premier, you know, photo ops for you guys over the years. What's the current best setup for getting cameras and pictures on those scrape trees now? How do you guys like to position them? And do you ever worry about those? You know, I've always worried about these cameras, like on a T-post or something right out in the open, like spooking some of the deer. Do you guys worry about that at all? And I guess, what are the other details for your setups on your scrapes?
No, I mean, we've never really worried about that. It's kind of like blinds on our farms. They're just like basically trees because all these deer have grown up walking past them. I mean, I would say over 60% of our cameras are out in the middle, you know, on T-posts and no, they have no fear of them, or we've never seen that. You know, the only thing we've ever had them get very weary on has been cell cameras. I don't know if it's a click or what it may be, but we've tried, but then again, like, that's only a very rare occasion, but other than that, we haven't really ever had any issues.
Right. Normally our cameras are on a T-post out in the food plot, and the scrape tree is main-framed, you know, main in the center of the frame, and then we try to position them to where if it's triggered, if a buck's there or a deer in general's there, you can see what else is out in the field, you know, get a background shot also, you know, kind of two for one, if you will.
Yep.
And then another key thing when setting up cameras, a lot of people don't realize, and is facing it not west, not southwest, and try and avoid even south, just because when that deer movement time is, it seems like
get a lot of sun picture.
Yeah, you just get them blown out or backlit, and you just can't really tell what it is. So avoid that southwest sun in the evenings, and so if you can face it north or southeast, or any northerly is ideal.
Yeah.
Because again, you can mess up pictures in a hurry.
Yeah.
And we always try and like to also be on the uphill side, kind of pointing downward versus if looking up a hill. Most of the time it gives you that backlit view. So we always try and, if you're on a hill, face it on the downhill, face it downhill. It seems to definitely help get those better quality pictures.
Yeah. You can add one of Mark's pet peeves is a sunlit back photo on a trail camera that me and Wade put out. He's not happy about that.
Oh, and the thing is we don't check those trail cameras very often now that we got cells. So, you know, you let it sit there for a month or so and all the photos are backlit.
Yeah.
That doesn't make a happy boss.
You gotta be aware of where you're at.
Yeah. Details.
Yes. So back to the food plot architecture side of things. So we've talked about the scrape trees will help you get shots. We've talked about the walking strips. What about actual shapes and designs of the plots? I've heard Mark talk about in the past about planting to the location. I think he will say sometimes. Mm-hmm. So like, pick a tree and then like design a plot around it. Can you talk through some of the design choices now? You know, it seems like a lot of guys will just make a big square or a big circle or something, mm-hmm. but I see you guys sometimes doing horseshoes and different things like that. What are some of those best designs you guys have found?
You know, one of the best and one that we have the most success on is that horseshoe shape. And again, planting to your position, obviously. We try and put our blind, you know, at the top end of the horseshoe, and you know, we have a plot, or a boomerang horseshoe, all the same, but we have a more of a radish type plot for, you know, bow season. They seem to like the radishes more during bow season. We'll plant that, you know, right up close to the blind, and then out on the ends we'll have, you know, winter bulbous sugar beets, or clover, or, you know,
standing beans.
Yeah. So the horseshoe is one of our favorites, just because they have to almost walk the whole plot to see what's on the other side, you know, so, or they'll be right in front of you where they can see down both sides. It just seems like they move through that type of plot better, just because they're, you know, so curious and they want to get to that point where they can see everything that's in the field.
Yeah. Are there any others that you've been using lately or that have worked well, or is that now like your the number one?
You know, another really good one that we like to do if we're just, I mean, we do a lot of green fields. Another main shape that we do in that is just like a football field. So like basically if they step into your green plot, you're going to get a shot. So 50 yards across, 50 yards either way. And, seems to be about the right size that they won't eat it out. You know, and really good size for bow hunting.
Yeah.
So those are probably the two best, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And always just natural structure that's on a farm. Like we plant some spots that have natural fence gaps where they've walked for years, and, you know, we bring our green walking strips through that fence gap and then bringing them past us in a blind. You know, natural structure works really good too. Also, if we create a new plot, like you were talking about, Mark picks a tree, and that's kind of the turning point of the horseshoe or boomerang, if you will. You know, that's kind of the center of it. So,
you know, another thing I think I've seen a few times, and I'm curious if this is something you do a lot. I've seen in some of these plots that are more of like rectangular-ish, I've seen what looks like you guys are almost building a wall or laying blowdowns in a wall kind of right near where your blind or tree stand is, and then leaving a gap though. So there's basically like, if you imagine you have a rectangle, and then if your blind is at the 50 yard line in the middle of the field, I've seen some plots where then on the opposite side from your 50, you'll have like a wall of trees that goes halfway across that pinches down the movement across that plot to really close to your blind or stand. Am I seeing that? Did you guys make those, or are those just some, you know, coincidental natural structure that I'm seeing in some of these plots?
No, we always use that type of stuff. You know, I mean, we put it on the same side as our blind as well, just again, for access coming and going, because going is just as important as coming. So you could slide down behind that wall of, you know, trees that you may have taken out of that plot when you built it, and, you know, not affect the deer that are on the plot. You just build it up high enough and slide in, slide out without the deer even knowing you're coming. And like what you were saying, the ones that are across the field, same thing, just as a, basically just to pinch them down, you know, deer pretty, easy to guide. They like the path of least resistance. So they're going to walk around the end of that and push them right in closer to bow range.
Yep. Recall another, these are like all the little weird things I've noticed over the years, but something that I heard, maybe it was you, Wade, talk about, or someone talked about one point, was thinking about where food plots will shade first, and that sometimes impacting how you plant or where you position things. Can you explain that a little bit? Because that's something I've never thought about before.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you watch a field, those deer that come out early, they always go to that shade. I don't know if it's, you know, I know why it is. It's because they feel more secure there, in that darker part of the field. Early season, it's cooler. So yeah, they'll definitely, go to that shaded side of the field first. Like I said, just for out of, whether it be early season in the heat, they go to that shade and they feel more secure in that. So yeah, we'll definitely try and get closer to that shady side of the field if that's the type of plot design that that we have in that particular spot. But they definitely, every single time you watch a field, you'll see that. If people pay attention to that, they'll definitely see where them deer are coming, and they'll early season, we've had them run across, like come out on the other side of the field, run across the sun, and just stop and put their heads down right in that shade, right at the shade line. And it's funny, as the sun starts to fall, the deer start to ease up, you know, just follow that shade line. They'll be right on it.
For sure. Especially early season.
Yeah, early season.
Warm is the main time for that.
It's interesting.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MeatEater. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/MeatEater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/MeatEater.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time: Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. And it's really simple. When you pour it into your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it do its job. Now, you probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again, because people everywhere rely on it to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. So, help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more. You mentioned the, when I asked you about the downed tree walls and stuff like that, you mentioned how sometimes you'll put those on your side of the field to help with access. Is there anything else you guys are doing with your food plots to help you with that access and exit? You know, some guys will hinge cut the whole side of a field so they can slip out behind that. Some guys do use blowdowns. I mean, I've heard all sorts of different things. What do you guys usually use or set up so you can get out of these places? I always wonder, like, you guys hunt so many field edge setups, and there's always so many deer on them. I'm always shocked that you guys can get in and out without these deer catching on really quick.
Yeah, for sure. Like this year in a big bottom we have, plant blockers, standing corn, any kind of blocker grass, if you will, plant that. Also, there's some spots where we jump in creek beds and walk those all the way from the road to the ladder of the back of the blind. I mean, you know, anything that puts you, your profile below, eyesight is great. And the corn worked really good this year. We haven't hadn't done that in that bottom this year and tried it, and it worked great. Snuck into that blind a few times with deer out on the field. Yeah. So,
and back to these smaller parcel farms, you know, access is key because coming and going, because, you know, if you only have one small farm and you got the right wind, you know, say three nights in a row, you're going to want to go back in there the next night. But, you know, by night two, if you blow that field off the second night in a row on your exit, you know, those mature bucks are going to, you know, it's going to start affecting them. So if you can get in and out of your blind without the deer knowing that you're there, like I said, exit's just as key as entrance. So if you can get out of there without them even knowing you're there, you're going to be able to hunt those small farms, you know, and not have to give them such a break, because if the deer don't know you're there, you know, and your wind's perfect, your access is perfect, you know, you'll be able to come and go as you please. So yeah. That's why we do on some of these smaller farms, you know, try and make access number one.
Yeah.
More so than our bigger farms.
I mean,
always number one.
Even when we get out of the blind, like, you know, you just get a flashlight out of your pack and, you know, get a light out so they don't associate with your wind or your scent when you get out of the blind. I mean, we even owl hoot, screech at them, coyote howl, something natural to get them to bump off the field, not just
walk down,
not just some guy climbing out of a blind, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Those are always stressful moments when you think you've got it cleared and you finally slip out of the tree and then something blows right behind you or something. But, yeah, we've all been there. Another kind of large topic that we probably don't have time to get into the real details of it, but it's also something that's been covered 1,000 times, and that's, you know, making decisions about what to plant. And that's very situation dependent and location dependent, soil quality dependent, all that kind of stuff. But I have noticed something, and I'm curious if this is true or if it's just something that I am mistakenly picking up on. It seems like rarely do I ever see a food plot that you guys have planted that's just one thing anymore. Like, it's very rarely just like an oat plot. It's usually like a combination of something, like a radish plot here in the corner by your stand, and then it transitions to something else, and then it transitions to something else. Is that the case? Do you guys always layer different things in each plot now? Or if so, why? And if not, you know, describe the situations when you would.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would say that is the case on a lot of our fields. And again, that's just, the whole sole purpose for that is hunting different times of the year. You know, we plant the products that they prefer late, whether it be grain or bulbs or brassicas, out at a distance when we would most likely be hunting with a gun. And then up close, you know, we have the clover or radish, something that they prefer, early season, you know, until that post rut time. You know, it seems like they really prefer those earlier. So we just plant basically on time of year that we're trying to hunt that particular field, if there's a particular target there, when we want to try and target him based on history with him, when he shows up, so on and so forth. So it just kind of determine what deer we're targeting. And then we almost sometimes will even plant for a particular deer of what he had preferred the year before, when he showed up, when we think we could kill him, stuff like that. So, but yeah, no, that is correct. We do layer for that purpose, basically, because most of our fields, we have to plant them big enough that, you know, that they'll make. So therefore, to get them within bow range, we have to plant a product that they prefer during bow season.
Yeah. What do you guys feel like, this is kind of going back to where we started a little bit, but as far as like the size of one of these things to actually make a difference, do you guys have like a minimum size food plot that you guys have found like, if it's less than this size, it really doesn't do much for us? Is that a thing in your mind, or will you do a half acre food plot if it's in the right place because it's still got some power at that size?
I would say, for sure, we will do a half acre. We've got some half acre green fields, but they're tucked into a bean field or corn field that's carved out. So there's more acres there for them to eat. I mean, and also, I think a lot of that depends on your deer density. You know, across the Midwest, whether it's you in Michigan or, you know, somewhere else in the Midwest and in the South, like there might be places where you only see 5-6 deer a night, where up here, there's so much habitat and the deer density is so high, we have to make that food plot mean something to them, not only from a drawing standpoint to draw them in, to get them to come feed there, but also, yeah, sustainable, that they're going to be able to feed on it for a month, 2 months, you know. In a lot of these places, you see 20, 30 deer. So got to have some acres to sustain those mouths.
That or just something that regrows, regenerates,
correct,
like clover or wheat, rye,
yeah,
you know, that type of grain.
Especially the walking strips, like they're so small and they work so good.
Yeah.
That's why we always go with, you know, wintergrass or, you know, wheat, rye, something that keeps growing even though they nip it off.
Yeah. Okay, so last food question, which is related to a challenge I know you guys felt this year, a lot of people felt this year, I did, and over a lot of recent years, which is drought. You know, planting a food plot in August, and then, you know, the rain that was supposed to come doesn't come, and you get a failure of some kind. What have you guys learned over these recent years as far as dealing with that, and how can you recover? You know, I used to think, like, I plant something, a drought came, and it was really crappy. And then I was kind of like, well, I'm doomed. And I've been trying later plantings and subsequent second or third seedings and different stuff like that. What have you guys found has helped you deal with that situation best?
Well, we'll say that all of our greenfields were doomed this year. We plant, I think, every single greenfield we went across, we replanted it 3 times. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the last planting did the best. And sometimes the second planting did all right. But you know, we have a trailer with a 650 gallon water tank on it that, you know, we target key bucks and, plots that we're wanting to try and kill them on. And, we'll go in, we'll fence off those plots and we'll water it. One of our best fields this year, we fenced off right after it was planted, didn't even let it get up. And Perry watered it. You know, he'd put an inch of rain on it once a week, and it turned out to be one of our best plots. And yeah, an inch of rain across an acre, what is it, 100 and some thousand gallons, I think. Astronomical amount.
Yeah, I watered 4 or 5 key plots this summer during the drought, and I had over 140,000 gallons of water put down, I believe is a rounded number. It was in that 140,000, 150,000 range.
What we watered this year.
It was, wow, it was insane.
And so
about eight takes a day, I would do. And we have a 1600 gallon tank that's bolted to a trailer with a pump. So
roughly 16,000.
Yeah. Gallons. About 16,000 gallons a day. And I did that for a few weeks.
Isn't that crazy? It's crazy how much work that is to do manually, and Mother Nature just does it so easily on its own.
Oh, one hour could save a week worth of work, you know?
It's crazy.
But yeah, I mean, we talk about that all the time of how, I was like, dang it, one half inch rain would save us a week's worth of work of solid work, you know, solid watering.
Yeah. Jeez. That's wild. And so how did that pay off for you guys? Did those 4 or 5 key food plots end up being worth it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely had some fresh green to hunt over. I don't know.
All of our third planting stuff, we planted all the way into October. The first part of October, I think we were planting wheat and oats, and we got those October rains, and it actually did all right, but that was our saving grace, that third planting that we went in and drilled. But yeah, those ones that he watered were definitely key spots because there was zero green anywhere.
Wow.
So we did have some key spots to hunt, but it's hard to grab all of them. You just have to pick your key plots and focus on those. That's all you could do.
So back to that third planting, would you guys say that, you know, doing that late September or early October planting of some kind of cereal grain, you know, sounds like that was still worth it. You got enough growth out of it that it actually helped, and the late activity didn't hurt you too much?
No, I mean, it definitely definitely helped us for, you know, as mild as this winter was. You know, they always come back to green really, really heavy right after the rut. And those were some of our best plots, with those, you know, wheat and oat cereal grain plots that we planted in late September, early October. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely made a huge change, because, again, there was no green anywhere else. No one else could get any green to grow because, again, they would give up after about the second planting, you know. So it did. Yeah. It definitely did pay off. But we went over those fields so many times, countless yeah. hours, all, you know, all for this season. And, again, that stuff, those weeks worth of watering, you know, just nonstop watering for 8-10 hours a day, you know, those three times across those fields, that's the things that a lot of people don't see and scratch their head when we're succeeding. You know, it's just the man hours that we put to make everything go around, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely an investment for sure. So I want to talk to you, Perry, about a specialty of yours, shifting gears here a little bit, since I've somehow sucked an hour of your time already just talking about food. You guys both talked about how important cover is, and cover is, you know, something sometimes that you're naturally blessed with on a property, and sometimes you have to create it. When it comes to creating new bedding cover or putting it in the places you want, you mentioned something really interesting, which is that you go out there with a chainsaw and you're going to, you know, walk into the timber until you know you're at least 100, 150 yards away from that food, so you can, you know, access without spooking deer off the bedding. Can you share any other specific detail type things you're thinking about when you go and try to create these bedding or better cover pockets with the chainsaw? What are some of the other things that you're thinking about when you're out there doing it, whether it's the locations, the size of these patches that you're cutting, any other decisions you're making out there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Mark doesn't want his entire timber looking like a deadfall, you know, with underbrush everywhere. So we kind of pocket it. We make, you know, we make little homes for the deer, if you will. You get that distance that we talked about earlier. You get to that spot and you look around, and in Mark's timber, I pretty much cut everything except oaks and walnuts. That's cleared by him. I mean, I'm not going to say that everybody needs to do that, but we pretty much take every tree we don't want besides those two species. And we make a, you know, whether it's an 80 by 80 yard or 50 by 50 yard shape or area, and we drop all the trees in that area. We might not drop them all. We might ring some just to have some dead stands and to get the sunlight to the floor. And we do this in areas that we, you know, on the 50 acre piece where Mark killed his big deer this year, it was wide open timber, a lot of hickories, younger 18 inch type hickories that, and a few oaks scattered in and out of there, but mainly hickories, which have very little, you know, food and wildlife specifies for deer at least, values. So went in there and did some pretty extensive TSI in a big area, about 150, 200 yards from that plot. And, this year, I mean, we held in that, it's probably 40 acres of timber in that timber. We held more deer in there this year than probably ever has in its entire life. 'Cause you could see from one end to the other, and now you currently cannot. So.
When do you choose to do the ringing versus completely falling the tree? Do you prefer to do bring the whole thing to the ground most of the time because it gets you that ground level cover plus the sunlight, or how do you make that decision between the two different applicate or ways to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm probably 70% bringing it down and 30% ringing. We've got some leases that people allowed us to do TSI, but they don't want a big mess. And so in that case, we, you know, ring more to let them stand dead, but you still get that sunlight to the floor of the forest. If I'm creating, you know, if it's a smaller farm where, say, I'm creating an 80 by 80 pocket of TSI, I'm going to bring a lot down, because
in that small pocket of timber, you're going to want as much floor cover as possible. You're going to want as many canopies you can get on the ground.
Yeah. What about hinge cutting? Do you guys ever do that?
Certainly. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's safe. Wear your gear and, you know, protect yourself and be smart of where you do it and where you cut the tree. But to get a tree to lay on the ground and continue to produce foliage, you got to hinge cut it. There's not a whole lot of other ways to get it there.
And do you do that in a similar kind of pocket kind of design like you're doing with your general TSI as well?
Yeah. Correct. Yes.
Okay. Now, another bedding area I see you guys hunting around a lot is some kind of grass. I see some pretty extensive use of some kind of native grasses, I'm assuming, on a variety of your farms. What do you ever plant grass specifically for bedding, or is it more often like transition from timber to food? I think I've seen both with you guys, but how do you guys usually look at grasses, and what are you guys using them for and how?
You know, we do one of Mark's first farms up here in Iowa was basically a cattle pasture with a giant draw down through the middle with a bunch of fingers off of it. And like I said, it was grazed by cattle for years. It was 3-inch tall grass. And, you know, he came in, this is before my time, but he came in, planted warm season grasses throughout the whole thing and rolled it in CRP and turned it into possibly one of the best farms in southern Iowa that literally was just a grown up cattle pasture. And mostly the grass served as a buffer to make those draws that much more appealing, you know, and give them that much more security cover, more so than the bedding. I mean, they do bed out in the grass, but I would say it's definitely more of a buffer to make the draws in the timber that much more appealing to the deer and access, you know, getting around the farm, getting from spot to spot. So they do bed in it, but I would say it's more of a transition buffer safety type thing for them. And, you know, we do a mix of big blue, little blue, Cave and Rock switch, and some different Indian grasses. And the reason that we do the mixture is because it gives the diversity and the heights. You're anywhere from, you know, 3 foot or, you know, knee to mid thigh all the way up to 8-9 foot tall grasses. And those pockets of that shorter grass allows the deer to walk through. You know, if you do solid Cave and Rock switch, you know, that stuff gets so thick that, you know, a deer can't even hardly walk through it or walk through it comfortably. So we do it, you know, with that mixture of different heights of grass. And you know, you could turn a cattle farm into a really good deer farm with you know, all that extra cover of the grass and then, you know, a little bit of TSI in the draws and stuff. But yeah, it's more of a buffer on our stuff than it is for actual bedding, I would say.
Okay. Is there anything else you guys are doing when it comes to that cover side of the equation? Any other tricks up your sleeve or projects that you work on many years that help on that side of things outside of grasses and doing some TSI?
No, not off the top of my head. You think of anything? I mean, those are the two main things that we do to improve cover.
Yeah. I mean, burns, normally on grasses though.
Yeah. We do burn our timber some as well.
Yeah.
Especially you have to watch your TSI areas because you'll burn all your cover there. So you kind of got to go around and, you know, make fire lines and stuff around your TSI so that doesn't burn up, but we'll run a fire through our timber and bring on that new growth. And you know, particularly right after, you know, the springtime, right after we do ring a bunch of trees and open up that soil so that sunlight from those trees that are rung can shine through it and it turn it into a jungle.
Wow. So what would be, you know, if you were to set off on your own, let's say you guys are now both, You've got a little nest egg from all your hard work. You've got a little money. You bought your own little farm, and you somehow have enough time to do your own work for a little bit. But Mark says, you can't use any of my equipment. You can't use my big water tank. You can't take my tractor. You know, man up, boys, and do it on your own. Figure it out. And so now you're on a tight budget, and you've got limited equipment, and your first farm is a little 40-acre piece or something. And you had to get started with a little bit more limited resources and stuff like that. What would be one thing you've learned from all your time here with Mark? What's one project or one thing you've learned that you would try to apply on a budget to improve your first farm? I don't know if something comes to mind, but if it's a food plot you're going to plant, how do you think you could do it on a budget with limited equipment? If instead you're like, man, I'm going to do this other kind of project, you know, how could you do something on tight time, tight budget in a small place? What would that one thing that comes to mind for you first, Perry, be?
I was going to let Wade go first, but I can tell you mine.
Okay.
I kind of got this. My dad and I have 80 acres together in Northern Missouri. We don't have a lot of money to do much of anything really, but, this year I'm going to frost seed almost 3.5 acres of clover. And, I bought $100 box blind and redid it. So I got a box blind and I'm going to have a huge clover field. So
there we go.
That's me really. I don't have a big green food source. You're going to have a lot of deer that use it. I mean, clover is one of the cheapest, easiest food plots you can do. And I mean, the palatability is amazing. We've killed a lot of deer on clover, and, cheap box blind hold a little bit of scent in, you know, get that upper hand on them. But that would be mine is a clover field and a good box blind.
I like it. What about you, Wade?
Yeah, I was kind of going to go down the same path, as Perry, in the fact of, you know, putting in, you know, hopefully you have a little bit of cover on that farm already that you can improve by, you know, most everybody owns a chainsaw, a little bit of TSI to thicken it up and hold deer. And then, you know, go in with a mower, you know, your lawnmower, and, mow down an area for a little food plot. And, you know, then go in and burn that area off. And then, you know, if you don't have a drill or anything like that, you could, you know, burn it and then top dress your clover and maybe roll it in with a cultipacker. You could go rent, you know, behind a four wheeler or a truck even. And, but clovers, like Perry was saying, is just so palatable to them. It's really easy to get to grow because it's such a small seed, and, it's pretty low maintenance overall. You know, you could take your house lawnmower and mow the weeds out of it. You could spray it with a backpack sprayer, and it keeps regenerating. So you don't have to have a giant food plot. You know, you could have a half acre food plot and be able to hand spray it or four wheeler spray it and not need all the equipment. But, you know, clovers, like I said, is pretty easy to grow and fairly cheap and easy to maintain and keeps growing year after year. So, I mean, if you just frost seed it in, you know, February, every year and keep the grass and weeds off it with spray, you'll have a food plot there every year with low maintenance and low cost.
Yeah.
So, I mean, plant food and TSI would be the two things that about anybody could do. Even if you go to your, you know, little rental place, they can about rent you a pull behind disc if you want to do that. Or, you know, it's not that expensive to rent stuff. You don't have to own everything, but you can definitely rent stuff that, you know, you could even pull one of those behind your truck. Everybody has a truck. So, you know, just small things like that is easy to do with just household stuff. I mean,
Yeah. Heck,
whenever I was in high school, my grandpa, he owned a 80 acre farm, and, my dad and I were out there with rakes and weed eaters, and we were, you know, raking. I mean, it wasn't a big plot at all, but we got a green field to grow by, you know, TSI and, you know, some of that, timber where the light would get down into it. We were right on the edge of the timber, because he had a crop field. So we had to go right on the edge of the timber, and we went in and, rung those trees where the light would get down to the plot. And, weeded all the weeds that grew in the timber and raked all the leaves out of there and got that seed down and raked it all in. It was a lot of handwork, but we had a small little green field to hunt over. So it could be done. You know, it takes a little time and a little bit of effort, and, but you could have a little plot
to hunt over for sure, but definitely food always helps.
Yep. Hard to argue with that. So I want to let you guys go so you can get your stuff together and get ready to go coyote hunting tonight. But one last question, which is that I'm curious, as you look forward to this new year, and I'm sure you guys have already been thinking about this, I got to believe that Mark's already staying up late at night, not sleeping, thinking about the one buck or the two big bucks or whatever deer he's hoping and praying will survive and make it to next year. I'm wondering if you have a buck like that in mind already, what do you think the most important habitat project is going to be for you guys in 2023 to help you kill whatever that one or two or whatever these target bucks are that you're really hoping are going to blow and survive next year? Is there one project that comes to mind that you guys are thinking like, man, there's probably buck A and there's this little food plot that I know we got to fix up? Or is there anything that you guys can think of off the top of your minds that you know you're really going to have to nail this year?
You know, the main thing is like all of our stuff is pretty dialed. I mean, we haven't really gotten any new farms over the last couple of years, so everything's pretty dialed in from that standpoint. So, I mean, the main thing that we got to focus on is just making sure we have good food plots. We get them in with the timely rain. We make sure they're prepped perfect, you know, just so we have the food that we need to sustain us all year to be able to kill that deer. I mean, that's our number one thing. Like I said, we've got everything pretty well dialed from the point of like improvements. I mean,
We just picked up a new 120 acre lease. It's kind of it'll be a project farm, if you will. We got clearance from the CRP program to do, you know, big green field. And it's kind of out away from, some huge cover. I mean, there's some good cover on it, but it'll be interesting to see what bucks we hold from summer to winter, because we don't have a pile of cover. We got some, so it'll be a nice project farm. I think we're going to dial it up real nice, and I look forward to seeing what it produces.
Nice. So, well, I think, you know, everybody should know to be checking out DeerCast and to be checking out the YouTube channel to follow along these kinds of things. But is there anything specific you want to send folks to check out, or for us to be keeping an eye out? Anything new we should be keeping an eye out for this year when it comes to content or anything else? Or should we just stay tuned and keep on following along?
Yeah, I mean, DeerCast is our main outlet for all of our new stuff. I mean, you know, you get in the now content right there. With turkey season coming up, we'll be doing all the lives again and having turkey season 23 where, you know, they could watch all of our turkey kills right there, you know, within a day or so of us killing. So we're going to get that instant gratification. So just stay tuned to DeerCast and the feed there. And best of luck to everybody this spring and working towards that fall.
Yep. We'll be here before we know it.
Turkeys beware.
We're ready.
Turkeys beware. We're coming for you. You guys can have the deer.
Well, hey guys, I appreciate you taking time to do this. I know that, this slight slowdown is, time that you cherish, I'm sure. So thanks for sharing a little bit of that time with me and talking habitat. This has been fun.
Absolutely. I appreciate it, Mark.
Anytime, man.
All right, and that's a wrap. Thank you all for joining me. Like I said, be sure to check out what they've got going on over on DeerCast. Big thanks to Wade, Perry, Mark, and the whole team. I've appreciated what they've shared with the world for many years, and with their generous, you know, the fact that they're always willing to chat with me and chat with us here at the podcast. I certainly have learned a lot, and I think a lot of you have too. So thanks, gentlemen. Thank you all for listening. It's time to start getting back to work. If we've had a little break from deer, now it's time to dive back in. We have work to do out on the property. If you own land or lease land or have access to something with a buddy who does have the ability to do improvements, it's a great time to get out there, do some work, have fun with it, and invest in your future now by doing this work and help all the critters that live out there too. So it's a win-win in my book. So thanks all. Appreciate you. And until next time, stay wired to hunt. Outdoor Adventure won't wait for engine problems.
Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.